Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producers are Jamie Lasante and Lou Pellegrino. Our guests this week are the producer and director of the upcoming Super Bowl. Fred Godelli is the executive producer of NBC Sunday Night Football and Thursday Night Football. He will produce his sixth Super Bowl on February 4th in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Drew Esikoff is the director of NBC Sunday Night Football and the network's Thursday Night Football director. He will direct his sixth Super Bowl on February 4th in Minneapolis. Fred Godelli and Drew Esikoff coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, as promised, we bring in Fred Godelli, the executive producer of NBC Sports' Sunday Night Football, and Drew Esikoff, the director of NBC's Sunday Night Football, also Thursday Night Football with both these guys. And they are the producer and director of the upcoming Super Bowl. Fred and Drew, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you.
Great to be back, Rich.
Fred, your media tour knows no end, so I appreciate you coming back my way. All right, I will direct. Your voices are pretty distinct, so I think people will pick it up, but I'll direct questions to each of you anyway so the listeners can pick up on stuff. Let's start off with this, and I'll start with you, Fred. Overall question, what worries you the most about February 4th?
A bad football game. You know, a game that's not close or well played. You know, we've done, you know, for Drew and I, this would be our sixth, for Al is 10th, for Chris is 4th. Our crew, our technical crew has been with us, you know, over 20 years. So we feel, you know, really good about going in to do the game. You just hope you have a great game. And the three games at NBC were all really pretty memorable. So hoping that luck continues.
Same question for you, Drew.
I'll reiterate what Fred said. My biggest fear is, is a bad game. We've had three great ones at NBC, two less, you know, not awful, but not great at ABC. And it's just making sure everybody tries to keep their routine as similar to the Sunday night weekly routine as we can and not try to do too much. Just do your job.
Drew, I want to stay with you, and you could take this both on the micro perspective in terms of how this would impact you as a director. You could also answer it as the macro, the larger NBC Sports production. But how is Super Bowl preparation for you different than how you would prepare for a postseason game? I'm interested in what the real differences are between high caliber playoff games and how you have to prepare and the ultimate game, the Super Bowl.
Well, I like to think we prepare each week like it is a Super Bowl or a high-level playoff game. Obviously, you're adding some equipment to it, but a lot of that equipment is added for the sole purpose of having a, you know, definitive view of a game that could decide the outcome of the Super Bowl. And a lot of that stuff is stuff that sort of, from my perspective, put on the periphery of the monitor wall, and I'll look at it when the time is right to look at it. But for me, trying to keep things as similar as they can be puts me in a comfort zone. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work for every director, but for me, that's been what I've tried to do. Obviously, there's a lot of hype surrounding it. That's one thing. We do a half hour out of our mobile unit leading up to kickoff, which we don't do every week, but we have done it at previous Super Bowls. But for me, the overriding philosophy is to try not to vary too much from the, you know, 17 plus weeks of the regular season in playoffs and the, you know, 18 plus or whatever years that we've been doing this together. So that puts me in my comfort zone.
Fred, what about on you? What about the technical side? How is it different? And obviously, to start with, there's certainly more cameras, but what's the difference between doing a Super Bowl and, you know, doing an NFC Championship or an NFC Divisional game?
Well, I mean, you know, from a pure technical standpoint, you know, the monitor wall, what I look at is expanded probably by a dozen machines. You know, it means 12 more, you know, replay sources. But, you know, both Drew and I, we made our walls at the Divisional game and took them home with us. So on my desk in my office is the monitor wall, And I know where all the monitors are from the regular season, but you know, during the day, I'll glance up, I'll train myself, I'll call out a machine name or number, and I'll identify it on that wall. So that's what that's different. And then you also want to be able to, you know, really utilize that extra material, in or the extra equipment, I should say, in very specific ways when situations come up. So you start thinking about certain plays and how would this camera that you don't have normally factor in, if it factors in at all. So there's more thinking. There's more kind of taking yourself through situations of games and how you might utilize some of these things. So it's just a lot of more. And then, you know, trying to get all that in your head and settled, you know, by the time Super Bowl Sunday gets around.
Fred, I want to stay with you, and this is something we've talked about previously. I'm always fascinated by this when it comes to the producer and director of a big sporting event. But certain teams obviously impact how you shoot the game. I guess you're even your replay approach. If some teams are fast, you know, especially in football, there's a different way to prepare for it. So as specific as you can, how do the Patriots and Eagles impact what you're going to show and do, whether in terms of pace or personnel?
Well, the Patriots, whenever you do the Patriots, at least ever when I do them, I am on high alert for something I've never seen before. Because these guys are brilliant and geniuses when it comes to devising plays and deploying personnel. So right off the bat, my antenna is up and it is very sensitive, and I'm just kind of waiting for something that is unusual. And I think, you know, probably Al and Chris would say the same thing. You know, Tom Brady, he rides the accelerator. He doesn't go at one speed. I think we know the instances where he likes to put his foot on the gas and go quickly. So we kind of anticipate when those are going to happen. I have somebody in my headset the entire game telling me sub, no sub. Because if the Patriots are going to sub, that I know I'm going to have time to do something else. If there's no sub, I'm taking a good look at that huddle or whatever they're using to get their play called to see if there's time to do something. See if there's time to do something else. So you know, really, really, the Patriots keep you on edge the entire game, I think, in a good way. The Eagles also run a little no huddle. That sub, no sub person, you know, in my headset, that really helps me a lot there. With the Eagles defensively, you know, when they go to their sub-rush package where they have three defensive ends on the field and Brandon Cox lined up inside, that's something I always want to know, because that's going to slightly change the isolation pattern a little bit and who's going to be who could be replayed on a certain play. But, you know, the Patriots really are, just like I'm sure – 31 other teams would tell you, they're the toughest team to prepare for.
That's interesting. Drew, in terms of how you will frame the game, opt for certain cameras, give us the images that we're going to see, how does the personnel of each specific team impact you and make it, if you can, specific to the Pats and the Eagles?
Well, I mean, you want to try to keep track of, you know, what players are in the game, what players are out of the game. You know, Fred talked about, you know, change of pace offense. We spent a lot of time a couple summers ago dissecting how to better prepare for teams that use a no huddle. We prepare a basic cheat sheet for our camera folks. What are the critical shots, whether it's the quarterback calling a signal, whether it's the guy with the defensive player with the green dot on his helmet counteracting that. Table cam has proven to be a very valuable source in telling all those stories with one shot. But the critical thing is to make sure that we are prompt in getting back for the snap of the ball, so the game doesn't take on a sloppy visual presentation. We figured out ways to include the key figures in that scenario while still getting back in time for the snap of the ball.
Fred, this is obviously something you never root for, but you are now an experienced broadcast professional, and you know that things can happen at a Super Bowl. We saw that at CBS in New Orleans when the lights went out. Can you take the listeners just through how you approach, even philosophically, contingencies, if you have a power outage, if you have a terrorist attack, if whatever the worst possible scenario might be, how do you prepare for that, knowing that you're broadcasting this event to more than 100 million Americans?
Well, Sam Flood and I, and Sam, as you know, is the executive producer of the entire sports department, and we'll be producing our pregame show on Super Bowl Sunday. He and I sit down and kind of go through a plan, which we haven't done yet. We usually do it, you know, by the end of this week. If we had the worst case scenario of a power outage, of, you know, a player who was really seriously injured, you know, God forbid a terrorist attack, and, you know, we get with NBC News to figure out how that baton is going to be passed if that situation should avail itself. If it's a power outage like they had in New Orleans a few years back, I mean, I know one of Michelle Tafoya's duties this week will be really to know every nook and cranny of U.S. Bank Stadium. You know, where is the electrical room? And how do you get into it? And, you know, meeting the head electrician and meeting the head law enforcement person on site, which would obviously be run by the National Football League, but to be able to try to get some answers pretty quickly. I would say the league is also pretty cooperative as well in terms of setting up a system where information can be passed on seamlessly and people can be alerted to what the situation is. So it's something that we definitely sit down and talk about and have a plan for. Again, you don't know when the situation strikes or if it should strike, how that plan might be modified, but you go in with a pretty good idea right away.
Drew, you may have been asked this before, but I find this question fascinating because you have to be aware of it at the same time. It can't be anything that sort of floats into your head. But one of the crazy things about the Super Bowl, and specifically in Las Vegas, is that people can literally bet on things that happen in the broadcast. Number of shots of the owner's box, number of shots of the player's wives, you know, how long the Star Spangled Banner is. How aware are you of the fact that your broadcast is part of prop bets? And if you are aware of it, do you basically just try to force yourself to not even go down that path?
Not aware of it at all.
Oh, look at me informing you, Drew, of what goes on.
No, I know it goes on, but I'm not thinking about that. Yeah, you know what? To be honest with you, that thought has never crossed my mind.
Okay, Fred, same question.
I mean, same thing. I mean, Rich, I could tell you this: in the course of my career, I may have known the point spread of a game. You know, I think I've done probably close to 1,000 games. I might have known the point spread 3 times. I mean, I'm not a gambler. I understand why people are interested in it, but it was never attractive to me. I was never attracted to it, and I really don't care about it. I understand why people do, but that's not what I'm there to do.
Fred, one last thing on this. It's not really a Super Bowl question, but given that we've talked a lot, and I certainly respect your opinion in this business, do you think we are far away from the point spread being either put on as a graphic or the announcers talking about it before each game, especially if legislation exists around the country where sports gaming is more legal in more states?
I think in today's current climate, the answer would be no. I think a lot of the leagues and the broadcast contracts actually legislate in the contract that you can't talk about, you know, the point spread on television. I mean, that's in the NFL deal. I mean, no one's really allowed to talk about that. And if the climate doesn't change, I don't see that ever changing. But if, as you point out, if we went to legalize gaming in a lot of states like New Jersey or New York or even across the country, then you could look at it as you're providing a service because there are, you know, this is a legal activity in America. But we're not there yet.
I know you guys aren't going to answer this, so I'll just ask it anyway, and I'll be more interested in how you don't answer it. Have you thought at all that this might be your last Super Bowl with Al Michaels?
I thought about if it's my last Super Bowl. I mean, honestly,
Do you want to break some news, Fred? I'm happy to.
No, I mean, I'm 57, but, you know, you're so lucky to do this game. And our business changes like every 5 years. There's always like every company I've worked for, every 5 years there was like a sea change in the company. So you just never know if you're going to get the other another opportunity. You know, you don't know if you're going to be healthy enough. I mean, you just don't know. So every one I have done, and I'll do this one the same, I'm going to approach it like this could be the last one. I hope it's not. I certainly want to do another Super Bowl, but I always approach it, hey, this is not a given, and this is not a, you know, this is not a right. You're pretty lucky today, so enjoy it and do the best you can. And I've approached every single one that way.
When I mentioned that you guys were going to be on this podcast, got a lot of questions, probably both from football fans as well as young people who want to who aspire to be where you are. So, Drew, this is for you. If your goal is to be a television director at the levels that you have gotten to, directing Super Bowls, you know, working, you know, Olympic Games, doing the Breeders' Cup, highest horse racing, what is the will the path for someone who's 23 be similar to your path? You know, working in trucks, sort of making your way up, or is the business change where there's a different path? I'd be curious if somebody wants to be in your seat and they're 25 years old, 20 years from now, what advice would you give them to go about doing that?
Yeah, I think the path to becoming a director will probably be the same. The outlet to where their work is being seen may change. But no matter what the digital age brings, you know, somebody's still going to have to be producing and directing events. Now, that may be done a little bit differently, but I can't imagine that there's not going to be multiple cameras involved and somebody that's going to have to select those shots. The other thing I would say is, you know, it's amazing when you look back of places you worked and how that experience, you know, helped you. You know, I worked the first couple years of my career basically in the studio operation. And those directing skills paid off a lot in terms of, you know, then, you know, making the switch to remote production. I worked at Sports Phone, which many young viewers would not even know what it is,
wow.
But it was the old 976-1313 number.
Right.
We had 59 and a half seconds to deliver 30 scores. Well, what did that teach you? You know, how to, you know, enunciate and give information in a quick, concise manner. And people say, well, that can't relate to being a TV director. Well, yes, it can. It related a lot. So any of that experience where you may think it's not valuable, when you've been doing it a long time, you'll look back and you'll realize it's a lot more valuable than you originally thought.
Fred, one of the questions that came up that is really interesting is, you know, what happens if the Super Bowl is a blowout? And so what's going on in the truck? Does the mood change? I mean, you guys are all professional, so I know the broadcast goes on. But does the energy, like behind the scenes, fade a little bit when the game is out of reach and, you know, you so want it to be something close and for the game to go down to the final minute, but yet it's, you know, it's 49-7 after the third quarter?
No, because I think that's when you really have to go to work. You know, I mean, look, we just sat in a three-hour meeting talking about the Philadelphia Eagles and brainstorming ideas for the telecast. I pray that 95% of these ideas never come on the air because that means we're in a major blowout, but that's what we're doing. You know, that's what we're doing. So at that point, I focus in a little bit harder and, you know, try to, you know, keep the interest level up, try to keep the entertainment level up and mix it with the live on the field and what's happening and who's doing well and who's not doing well with some of these, you know, storytelling elements that can hopefully keep people's interest and entertained if the game itself isn't doing it because of the score.
Fred, this one more for you here. Is at this point of your career and tenure, when it comes to determining the right amount of replays on a play, is that a feel thing, or do you have, like, always in the back of your mind maybe what a certain number should be on replay?
No, you know, I think, you know, I try to have as few rules as possible, because I think when you lock yourself into limits and rules, you're locking yourself into probably regrettable decisions. Sometimes, or I should say most of the times, replays are determined by is the team at the line ready to snap the ball. That is usually the biggest determining factor of how many replays a play is going to have. If you get lucky and there's a score and you're not going to commercial and now you have that time between the extra point and the kickoff to do, you know, replays. The one thing that, you know, we try to do, and I talked to my replay director about it and all the replay operators, we just want high impact shots. So if it's a catch, if it's a run, if it's an interception, we want the shots first that tell you why this happened or show you why this happened. And then if there's the, you know, emotional aftermath, which in championship games there usually is, let's not settle for okay shots. Let's make sure all the great shots come on the air. So usually the next play dictates the number of replays, but I don't ever go in with a set number in any situation.
Drew, and you're welcome to get technical on this, and you can certainly explain to the audience if it is, but do you have a favorite camera? Or a favorite camera placement for a football game? And if so, what is it and why?
Well, you know, my view is you want to use the camera that puts the audience where you'd want to be seated at that particular time. But I will say, I mean, I think Skycam has become a, you know, an intimate shot that both brings, you know, the audience down as close to field level as they probably feel comfortable sitting, while also being, you know, wide enough on the wide side to become part of the technical replay packages that the audience is expecting as well. That being said, following up, I mean, I think, you know, low end zone cameras provide a, you know, an intimate look at the game. There's the cameras that can get inside of a player's helmet, but we are not, you know, with high definition now, the idea of, you know, repetitive close-up after close-up after close-up, at least on our crew, is a thing of the past. With HD, the more you can see, the better. You can see everything clearly. So, no, I don't really have, you know, I don't have a favorite camera. I think you may have a favorite camera at each specific timeline of the game is probably the best way I could describe it.
One of, you know, people who work in the sports media or who are fans of this content, know that you two are one of the great director-producer teams in sports broadcasting history. I'm going to, you know, throw you some PR love. Put my Dan Masonson hat on here. That might be the only time I'll do that. And the reason I ask that is because it's not always the case. You can have an incredibly talented director and an incredibly talented producer, and for whatever reason, they clash. Chemistry, personal, animus, whatever. But for you two, it's worked. It's worked over multiple companies. It's worked over multiple years, and so I'd be curious for both of you. Fred, why do you think that is? Why, whatever the chemistry is between you and Drew, either professionally or personally or both, it's worked. Why is that?
I'd say it's a couple things. We grew up in the same area of the country during the same time, so, and we're huge sports fans first. I think we're more sports fans than we are television fans. And all our sports memories are the same ones. You know, Willis Reed, Game 7. Chris Chambliss, 1976. I mean, all our sports memories are New York memories, and they're all the same. I think we both wanted to be the next Marv Albert when we were growing up, and that didn't really work out for either one of us. So I just think that right off the bat, you know, there was a sameness to both of us in terms of sports and how we saw sports and our passion for sports. And then I think the other part of it is we're probably opposite. You know, I mean, you know, Drew is funny. He knows how to keep things light. And the crew really loves him. I'm intense. I want things done, you know, right all the time. And not that to say Drew doesn't, but I'm just more intense. And I'm guessing the whole crew doesn't love me. But, you know, I think they respect me. But I think it's that... I think it's that counterbalance, you know, you can call it good cop, bad cop, whatever you want to call it. But I think that works.
I like that. Drew, your response?
Yeah, we are different. And, you know, Fred is obviously, you know, my best friend, best producer I've ever worked with. And I'm happy to let somebody else be the leader. I have no desire. I'm very happy just being the director of Sunday Night Football. And so I don't have, you know, and I'm not going to name names, but I can see in other eras of the industry where a director may have wanted to ascend to make decisions that the producer should be responsible for and Fred wants to be responsible for. I have no desire to be responsible for those decisions. I'm very happy doing exactly what I'm doing.
We all know the importance of getting a good night of sleep, right? Well, guys and gals, let me tell you about Mattress Firm. Let's keep the ball rolling, shall we? The base for my argument is simple. Your bed budget can go further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this. They are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low-price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. You both are the producer and director for the most-watched program in U.S. television history. That it, unless I believe I'm correct about this, 114.4 million viewers watched the Patriots beat the Seahawks on February 1st, 2015. Thrilling, basically, end of game finish. So you're part of basically the most watched program in the history of the U.S. That's an incredible accomplishment. You both know that viewership has been down over the regular season the last 2 years, and it's been down in the playoffs. Do you how would you feel if you did a exceptionally produced broadcast, yet for whatever reason you look at the viewership number on the Monday after the Super Bowl and it's like 103 million or 102 million? Is there an ego factor there, Fred, or are you at the point where you can't control viewers, you can only control what you can control?
I mean, I think we're at a point where I can only control, or Drew and I can only control what we can control. I mean, you just, you know, went through the ratings and how they, you know, work this year. I mean, I know that game you referenced, Patriots-Seahawks, is a point of pride for both of us. That's a pretty cool thing to have. And we had it once before that, too, I think, when we did the Arizona-Pittsburgh Super Bowl as well, or the Giant-Indy Super Bowl, a Giant-Patriots Super Bowl, I should say. But no, I mean, look, you know, we thought we had some fantastic shows on Sunday night this year, and you know, they weren't at the level in terms of viewership as they were in previous years, and you really can't control that. I do know that everything is cyclical; nothing goes straight up like a rocket. So I will say this about this game: you kind of have the ingredients that you need. You have, you know, the reigning champions that no one thinks can ever be beat in these games. And then you have a city that, you know, has never won it. And it's a city that has long been identified with and embraces the whole underdog motif. So I wouldn't be surprised next week if Philadelphia Eagles pick up some steam around the country with people kind of tapping into that underdog role. And then, of course, you know, who can beat the Patriots? No one. Right? That's what everybody feels. So if we got that kind of game on February 4th and we were up to the task, you know, in terms of presenting it, you know, I would be hopeful that maybe we could inch past what we did.
All right, a couple more here and I'll let you guys go. I thought this was a great question that a reader asked. What are some of the behind-the-scenes mistakes, even if they're incredibly slight, that only you two know have made it to air in past Super Bowls? That's just interesting to me that even if it was just something that maybe was on the screen for a half second or a second or something that you wished had done differently. Drew, is there anything that comes to mind immediately about if you had that moment back in a certain Super Bowl that you've done, you'd want it back and what it was?
There's a couple. There was a camera right in front of Victor Cruz on a salsa dance. that we used as a replay, but I didn't get it on the air live. But a viewer, I mean, if you're looking for something that a viewer would know, you could have 108 million viewers, and unless somebody was astute enough to know why didn't they get that on the air live as opposed to in replay, probably nobody would know the difference. I miss when you're trying to look at 50 cameras at once, you can't possibly look at 50 cameras at once. Now, should I have known that the handheld was right there? Yeah, but in the heat of the moment, you miss those things. You miss those things every game, every Super Bowl, every Sunday night football game. I'm sure if you went back and looked at each camera's recorded reel, you would say, I should have seen that, which is why, for many of the games, I record the real-time output of my monitor wall, and a few times a year, I'll go back and it's recorded for other purposes, but a couple times, a year, I'll go back and just say, yeah, I should have been looking here, should have been looking there. But that happens on every single show. I'm sure you could find something that you should have done, a little bit better.
Fred, I know you have these, and I remember one time we talked. I don't remember what the year was, but I thought it was like just fascinating that you had told me this. It really bothered you one year that when you went to halftime of the Super Bowl, you did not tell the viewers what team was getting the ball to start the second half. And ever since then, you changed it up, and now that's an NBC staple. I think everybody else has copied you, if they haven't, they've come close. So I remember that one sticking out. That was one you wish you had, and then you changed up. But I imagine you probably have some that come to mind in terms of if you had the opportunity to do again, you would do it.
We'll have to call my psychiatrist and get him to read the list. Rich, I mean, look, I was watching the James Harrison play this morning. I was putting a tape together for our camera meeting, and I wanted to put the Harrison 100-yard interception return on it. And so I hadn't watched the play probably in 4 years, and I watched it, and it was covered, it was covered pretty well. But I'm saying to myself, well, I wonder why I chose that replay instead of SkyCam. I think SkyCam would have been a better look here for the entire picture. And then I was looking at Santonio Holmes's catch, and one of the first replays I showed in the catch was really the best look, but I never went back to that look again. I went to other looks that showed it, but I didn't go back to the best look. And it's usually things like that will gnaw at you until they stick you in the ground. But I've got hundreds of those. Even the Music City Miracle, I can go back to that play, and again, I got a great look on the air. It was right on the line. And then I showed other replays, but I never went back to that look, and that really was the look. It got on. It wasn't like it didn't get on, but that's the look that should have been shown over and over and over again, and I didn't do it.
All right, here are the final two. Drew, again, you want to have perfection, I know, from talking to Fred many times on every play. But the interesting thing about the Super Bowl is that, and at least when people, just your average fan, judges the broadcast, if you guys nail whatever the signature play is of the game, I always feel there's a direct line from that to whether people enjoyed the game or say great things about the game. So, like the Tyree catch, end of the Malcolm Butler interception, et cetera. When these moments are about to happen, and obviously you can't always anticipate it, but you can't anticipate late game stuff. Is that ever floating through your mind that, like, man, this is like the one sequence, we got to have everything and we got to do it perfect because it's one of these plays that are going to last, 100 years, 150 years, long after both Fred and I are gone?
Yeah, I mean, sure you do. I mean, but that's the good part of that is that means you have a great game, and hopefully the focus has been at, the highest level the whole day. But those are the instances where you want to make sure that, both sides of the story are covered. For every hero on a play, there's going to be a guy who was the goat as well, or the dejected player. So it's covering both sides of those stories. And the one thing that I find most challenging as you go into a Super Bowl is that real estate that you are used to having available to you during the regular season, meaning the sidelines, are really, really congested during a Super Bowl. And shots that you'd normally look specifically to the handheld camera area of your monitor wall, they're not always there at the Super Bowl. And yet, really, and I'll make that point, vividly clear at the camera meeting, that sometimes in a Super Bowl, if you can't get the perfect shot, you at least have to get the right shot. So if it has to come from a, you know, a higher camera or a camera across the way, so be it. But the real estate is so congested. Now, what all these people are doing down there, I have no idea. But they're down there, and they are in the real estate very often, the real estate that has been sold to the network cameras, that real estate's not always available to you, so you have to have backup plans. But the answer to your question is, yeah, you're hoping that you're going to get one of those, you know, crazy, crazy endings, and that you're there to cover both the jubilation and the dejection. And very often the dejection is a more compelling shot than the jubilation.
That's well said. Okay, final three for me. What time do each of you get to the game? And if you can explain for listeners, where are you at U.S. Bank Stadium in relation to what we are watching on TV?
So if you're looking at the field, right, on your television set, we would be on the near sideline right end zone, so where the Patriots will be entering from and exiting on Super Bowl Sunday. We're at the end of that tunnel. That's where our TV truck compound is. So that's where we'll be. So we're only about 50 yards from the field. And then we start a two-hour technical rehearsal at 10 a.m. on Super Bowl Sunday. So we'll be arriving sometime shortly before 9.
Wow. Drew, we always hear that the Super Bowl has sort of more cameras than a regular season, you know, the most cameras in the history of any televised NFL game. If you want to use this year, you can, or if you just want to use sort of the thesis for the question, but how many of those extra cameras, the additional cameras beyond a regular season game, are ultimately used in the Super Bowl? Are there things that just are never used but you have available, or do you end up using all these new cameras and gadgets, et cetera?
A combination of both. The ones I can tell you that definitely get used in addition, you know, above and beyond a normal Sunday night game. On a regular Sunday night game, we'd have three what we call play-by-play cameras. Usually, you know, just for, you know, for reference, at about the 20, at about the 50, and at about the opposite 20. For this game, we add live play-by-play cameras down the goal lines to try to make that view better. So that's two more that you'll use. We're adding a couple of, one additional Steadicam, one additional handheld. Those will definitely get used. We're adding two additional low end zone cameras. Those will definitely get used. And we're adding three additional reverse angle cameras, one at the 50 that gets used a lot, and the other two are sort of reverse angle play-by-play cameras that get used less so. In addition to that, there's cameras designated to protecting the end lines. They would only get used in a situation where a inbounds or out-of-bound play as it relates to the end line is concerned. And the rest are, catch-as-catch-can. It's, cameras in the hallways, in the club lounges. A lot of that is just used for team entrances, so on and so forth. So of all the additional cameras, probably, 10 of them get used as, internal to the normal cut of the show. The other ones would be used in just game-specific situations.
Oh, that's fascinating. All right, the last one from me, and I'd like you both to answer. We'll start with you, Fred. Outside of football, what is the hardest sport, in your opinion, to produce, and why?
Of the sports that I've produced, I would say the Kentucky Derby. You're on the air for 4 hours for a two-minute race, and these are horses. They can't talk to you, so you have no idea what they're going to do, how they're feeling, if they're actually going to make it to the gate. Churchill Downs is a large, large facility. You have people spread out over miles, and there is so much unpredictability in horse racing, because obviously you're there for that great race, that two-minute race at the end, but you're covering other races and things happen. Jockeys get injured, horses get injured. In some, you know, really unfortunate cases, horses have to be euthanized. But it's a really challenging event, and you're basically back timing 4 hours to get to the gate for 2 minutes. And of the sports that I've produced, I found that the most challenging.
It's interesting. Same question for you, Drew.
Yeah, I would say the Derby is the hardest show that I do too, and there's so much traffic, there's so many announcers, there's probably, I'm going to estimate, you know, this is not an exact number, probably between 200 and 300 tape rolls in a Derby show, because what you do is the venue is so big that you end up recording stuff all day, so you may need a shot of a trainer who could not, conceivably may not be on premises, but he was there 3 hours ago, so you may roll a shot back off tape just for documentation so the viewer knows what the person looks like. So from an event standpoint, that's a really difficult show to direct. From a pure sports standpoint, I haven't done it in a long time, always found auto racing to be a real challenge, especially on a road course, and especially when the producer goes, okay, this guy's 30 seconds in the lead, now let's pick up the battle for 12th and 13th place on a road course where every turn to the novice like I was looks exactly the same. So that to me, auto racing was always a real challenge to do.
We'll send you to Le Mans very soon, Drew. That seems like a fun one. Fred Gadelli is the executive producer of NBC Sunday Night Football and Thursday Night Football. This on February 4th, he produces his sixth Super Bowl. Drew Eskoff is the director of NBC Sunday Night Football as well as the network's Thursday Night Football. And like Fred, he directs his sixth Super Bowl on February 4th. These two basically are the best of the best and deserve the accolades that they get. Fred and Drew, safe travels and have a great game. And thank you very much for joining me on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks, Rich. Always love it, Rich. Thanks.
All right. Well, back in the studio, my thanks to Fred Gadelli and Drew Eskoff, the producer and director of the upcoming Super Bowl. And, like I said in the podcast, those guys, their reputation and, honors precede them. I'm considered basically one of the great producer-director teams of all time. And so I hope that was interesting for you. Certainly interesting for me. Previous podcasts, Jim Nantz, we had for 84 minutes talking about Tony Romo's success and how he preps for the NFL and the Masters. Katie Nolan, ESPN's new hire, Jemele Hill, Mike Francesa, and then our roundtable part. The last one we did was with Neil Best of Newsday and John Allrand of the Sports Business Daily, and that was about the viewership potential of the Patriots-Eagles Super Bowl and NBC's upcoming Olympic coverage and why the coverage of the USA Gymnastics scandal just took so long to gain national prominence. If you like the content, please leave us a review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. We're also on Stitcher and Google Play. For Jamie Lasante and Lou Pellegrino, for Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.